Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the Mystic.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. In this episode, I continue reading from Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland, my memoir about life in the church. And things are about to get serious. I've enrolled at Trinity College at the University of Toronto to begin my divinity degree. All going well, I should graduate in 3 years and be rewarded with a degree in my hand and a clerical collar around my neck. But all would not go well. Here then is chapter 5 of Lost Rites, the first of 3 parts. If Harry Potter had been flying on his broomstick around the time I started at Trinity, I would have thought I'd fallen through the magic portal and ended up at Hogwarts. Trinity College was a magical castle, with stone arches and hidden staircases and thick wooden doors. It would have made a perfect setting for a masterpiece theater murder mystery. It even had a porter at the entrance, monitoring the comings and goings, not to mention the secrets of the residence. The central quad was enclosed on all sides, protecting college life from the prying eyes of the public. Inside the buildings, treasures abounded. Like in Strawn Hall, the tall, wood-paneled dining room, which openly displayed behind the high table a massive, faded, 14th-century tapestry of Flemish origin. Trinity was decidedly English, aristocratic, and grandiose. This was intimidating for a middle-class boy from the suburbs. My family wasn't poor, but neither were we privileged. Not like this. As to my academic qualifications, I left York with the praises of my profs ringing in my ears. Well, two of those profs anyway. But I should have taken that in its proper context. York had accepted an unpromising student with a low-grade average and then expressed its surprise and delight when he made good. That's not quite the same as being an intellectual wunderkind. By contrast, the undergrad students who were accepted into Trinity had to be shining stars to begin with qualifying grade averages from high school 25 to 30 points above mine. Not only that, but some of them had been flown halfway around the world by their prosperous parents to be part of this elite school. Self-doubt accompanied me to this new territory. Was I smart enough to be there? Was I savvy enough to pull off looking like I was smart enough to be there? Was I destined once again to feel like the interloper, the new kid, the one who didn't belong? Fortunately, it did not take long to scratch the surface of my new community and recognize the flesh and bone that bound us all in our common, even squalid, humanity. All faculty and students who dined in Strawn Hall were required to wear black academic gowns. The gown was meant to be an equalizer, displaying outwardly one community united by the pursuit of academic excellence. But the gowns did nothing to hide the youthful exuberance of those who wore them. Many were torn and stained, their slow putrefaction having begun in the dining hall itself, where first-year students were routinely poured out, a hazing ritual of forceful removal for their poor behavior. The divines, the name given to divinity students, were generally older than the rest of the student body. Some were married and lived off campus, though some of the single ones chose to live in residence. During my first year, Joan and I continued to live in our basement apartment up in Downsview at the north end of the city. This meant I was a commuter and unavailable for most of the extracurricular life of the college, I was spared most of the excesses of student life until we moved into town at the end of that year. The gathering place for the divinity students was not Strawn Hall, but the Buttery, the college cafeteria for day students, where we caught up with one another between classes. More formally, we met in the Rhodes Room for class meetings and social occasions, where we would carry out our business or sip our sherry beneath the solemn portraits of the college's Rhodes Scholars. This is where the weekly breakfast buffet of buns and bacon was taken following the Friday morning Eucharist, where Tim Foley had brought me as a youth group member 5 years earlier. The separation of the divines from the undergrads was appropriate, considering our formation as future clergy. It demanded of us something more mature, more sober than was the norm for the rest of the college. Still, the boisterous life of the undergraduates served as a foil for the gravity of our work. It guarded against taking ourselves too seriously, especially when rock music blared from open residence windows into the quad below and used condoms were strewn about the lawn. Some of us even borrowed from the freedoms of our educational setting for one last chance to raise a little dust and down a little drink before the clip of the clerical collar would restrain us. Despite my recreational drinking and drug use in high school, I didn't learn how to drink, seriously drink, until I attended Trinity. Scotch in general, and LCBO Special Light in particular, 188B on the product listing board at the liquor store. One night, I tied one on till dawn with a particular professor. This was a learning experience in and of itself, that seminary students could be drinking buddies with their profs. I discovered that night that if you took your scotch with a lot of water, you could share a whole bottle between the two of you without feeling too bad the next day. Dehydration is the enemy of the drunk, not booze. Or so we told ourselves. According to another tradition all our own, a few of us would meet up from time to time in someone's residence room late in the afternoon for what we called a high wine divine. This was a social gathering around a punch bowl comprising two parts dark rum to one part tawny port, a British version of the classic Manhattan. We would then sidle off to chapel for evensong, linking arms and walking like the intrepid adventurers in The Wizard of Oz. We may even have sung, "We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz," but I can't actually remember. When we arrived at the chapel, we had to appear to be in our right minds, sitting sedately in our academic gowns. This proved difficult, like a kind of endurance test, especially the day the reading came from the Book of Genesis, orated dramatically by a faculty member from the English department who rolled his R's and over-enunciated his words. "My brother Esau," he read, "is an hairy man, but I am an smooth man." It was too much for us to bear. What began as ripples of movement up and down the pews, the shuddering of black-gowned shoulders, devolved into muffled snorts and squeals. But then came the first all-out guffaw, and all hell broke loose. The reader soldiered on, but the moment was no longer his. Sometimes our humanity spilled out in darker ways. There were various dalliances and trysts among members of our class, as one might reasonably expect of young adults bound closely together in a common pursuit. But one beloved divinity professor was dismissed some years later when it came to light that he had known, in the biblical sense, half the women of our class, all of them bright and courageous, the first women to step forward to break the male-dominated gender barrier of the Anglican priesthood. Another prof resigned his position and was suspended from the priesthood when allegations of sexual abuse surfaced involving a minor. For a former Jesus freak with Bible-based uber morals, Trinity's shadow side was troubling. Even as I took advantage of some of its tamer offerings myself, it seemed like license to me, which was only a few letters short of being licentious. but it was also more honest than hiding our excesses and our failings away and pretending we were holier than we were. You could dress us up in robes and parade us around a magic castle, but you couldn't disguise our humanity. We were indeed in Hogwarts, hogs, warts, and all. I entered Trinity with a head full of questions and an openness to new answers. I also arrived with the remnants of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. I was ready to give up my stock theological certainties that Jesus died on the cross to save our souls from hell, but I still clung to a personal faith of childlike trust that didn't go over too well with my new classmates. In lectures and in seminars, we considered God only at arm's length, as the Holy Trinity, or the Divine, or, more exotically, the Numinous. But sometimes I stumbled, reverting to my old language that assumed a more personal connection. "Why wouldn't we just pray about that?" I blurted out one day in the buttery. "You know, take it to the Lord." My classmates looked at me strangely, as if perhaps I was an interloper from Wycliffe, across the street. Then I mentioned to a professor that I was considering studying the Christian notion of holiness, to which he replied, "Sure, whatever the hell that means." If at first my personal faith seemed a bit eccentric to the others, that was entirely permissible in a college that called itself a divinity school, not a seminary. A seminary presumes to mold its students according to a particular spiritual tradition. A divinity school offers an academic education, period. Trinity had no interest in turning out cookie-cutter Christians, all believing the same things in the same way. Our personal faith development was up to us. So, if I wanted to talk to Jesus, that was my business. In fact, Trinity's particular genius was found not so much in its academic offerings, from biblical studies to theology to church history, which in any case it shared with the wider interdenominational Toronto School of Theology. It was in its liberal understanding of faith itself. This was reflected in our unofficial mantra, ambiguity and tension, or TNA, as we used to call it. Truth, we were learning, was ambiguous, or hard to nail down. Every time you think you've got it, the diamond turns in the sunlight and you catch the glint of a different facet with different properties. So truth's competing claims were not to be resolved so much as held in a creative tension. All the facets were true. It just depended on how you looked at it. That's why Trinity didn't presume to take responsibility for our spiritual formation. Instead, it offered a diverse program that put the onus on us, the students, to find our own unique path. Anchored by the historic teachings and practices of the church, our individual faith was to be as distinctive as we were, even if that meant the cultivation of eccentricity, which it turned out Trinity was particularly good at. But Trinity was also good at providing us with training opportunities where we could put our beliefs into practice. For instance, our diminutive dean, Howard Buckner, offered several not-for-credit courses to prepare us for the actual tasks of ministry. In a class we called Deansing, we followed his timid hand gestures like he was conducting a chorus of crickets as we learned to sing the liturgy, the Psalms in particular, according to Anglican chant and plain song. We learned to read in public. We called it Dean Speak, which he recorded on an antiquated reel-to-reel tape recorder so we could hear how quickly our dropped consonants got lost, bouncing off the hard surfaces of the chapel walls and floors. In our third year, Dean Buckner put us behind the altar to teach us the art of presiding at the Eucharist. We referred to it as priestcraft, an exacting science in the Anglo-Catholic tradition that required attention to detail and also to that most elusive gift, poise. While he himself spoke softly, some would say he mumbled, he taught us how to convey through our words and actions the profound mystery of God's presence in worship. More significantly, the college also arranged field placements for us out in the real world to prepare us for the ministries we would one day take on. Churches, hospitals, and social service agencies provided us with a wide range of opportunities to engage our evolving faith and practice our new skills. My first field placement was at the Addiction Research Foundation, housed in the Clark Institute of Psychiatry, several blocks off campus. I sat in on interviews and assessments, observed group therapy sessions, debriefed with my supervisor, and slowly built an appreciation for the harsh realities of addiction. It was new territory for me, and I approached it nervously. Give me a classroom or a stage, and I could do something with it. But put a real person in front of me, one-on-one, with real life-and-death issues at stake, and I wasn't so sure. My supervisor recognized this and addressed it in my evaluation. I feel that with further experience, she wrote, Brian can overcome any sense of hesitancy or restriction in his role as counselor. I wasn't good at it, but I knew counseling skills were important for ministers. I could be good at it, I thought, if I could just get past my self-consciousness. So I signed up for a 12-week immersive training program the following summer as a student chaplain at the Toronto Western Hospital. The six of us in the class were each assigned wards for which we were to assume pastoral responsibility. Our caseload would come from referrals made to us by the medical team. We were tertiary care at best, behind the doctors and nurses, somewhere just above the custodial staff, so we had to prove our worth before we could expect an invitation to become part of the team. We met as a class in the mornings for instruction and discussion, but otherwise we were expected to be interacting with patients. We were also expected to write weekly verbatim reports of some of those interactions for review by Ted Poulter, our supervisor. This is how I know how truly awful some of those early visits were. Like the one that started with me announcing, Hi, I thought I'd just drop by to see what the action is. To which Ted wrote in the margin, Hippie. Or the myriad distracting misfires where I shot wide of the target. The patient tells me he's half asleep, and I reply, Oh, which half? What the hell? The very worst of my verbatims reveal a happy, clappy young chaplain trying to bring cheer to someone who had just come from surgery, feeling like they could vomit, or another who had fallen into a pit of deep depression, as if all they needed was a little faith and a sunny disposition like mine. I cringe. Repeatedly, Ted had to remind me in the margins of my verbatims to let them do the talking, to stop making awkward, chaplain-centered remarks, and to go with the feelings being expressed, not just the words. By the end of the 12 weeks, his coaching began to pay off. I can see in the verbatims that I was becoming more present to the patients. I listened, and I asked clarifying questions when I didn't understand, especially about what they were feeling. I became more honest with them about my own feelings. One older man told me to go away because everybody just wanted to ask him more questions. I nodded. I heard what he was saying. But I said I was disappointed to hear that. I had enjoyed our last conversation, I said, and thought he had too, which helped turn things around. He opened up to me then, saying he felt depressed. His long stay in hospital exceeded anything he'd been expecting. He just wanted to go home. I wasn't family, but perhaps a sympathetic ear could take him halfway there. This slow transition toward real attentiveness in my counseling was noted in Ted's final assessment. He had started out calling me the kid, his way of chiding me for my youthful enthusiasm, and also perhaps for my naive faith. In the end, he saw something else. I have seen real growth, he wrote, and the excitement that accompanies it in Brian. He seems to be experiencing a wholeness and integrity that he has been searching for. I feel good about his progress. So did I.
And when that foghorn blows, I will be coming home.
I've been reading from Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. This has been the first of three parts making up Chapter 5. Thanks for listening. As always, I invite you to leave your comments or share your own stories about the spiritual journey. You can post in our Facebook group, The Mystic Cave, or you can write me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. At Trinity, the foundation was being laid for a life in ministry, but it didn't go deep enough to intercept the stirrings of my soul. My spirit was rising to comprehend new, light-filled ideas about God, but my soul was screaming with voices from down in the dark, demanding their own obeisance. Stick with me for part two. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. But it's too late to stop now. It's too late to stop now.